Brad Hayes, Associate Professor of Political Science, Union College, PhD in Politics from the University of Maryland, and a guy who knows his stuff. Jerry Nadler, I grew up on the west side of Manhattan. He's a little younger than I am, but not that much. And I watched him. He is a guy, he's like the pit bull who gets something in somebody's hand in his mouth. He doesn't stop. So he's a worthy adversary for Donald Trump, in my opinion. That doesn't mean you have to like him, but he is a worthy adversary in this thing. So talk to us about the Attorney General Barr and Mr. Nadler.
So this is a fascinating fight, right? We see that the House has now moved to hold Barr in contempt after failing to show up to testify and failing to produce the Mueller report in full. The Judiciary Committee has voted that contempt resolution forward, so it'll now fall to the House as a whole. But it seems quite likely to pass the House chamber as a whole. And then you'll have this situation where the Attorney General, of course, is being held in contempt. And the question is what comes next. And, to me, this is a fascinating moment of constitutional politics at play, because, of course, if we go back to kind of the original constitutional design, we see in some ways some of the imperfections of our constitutional system at play here. Right. First and foremost, the congressional role of oversight and investigation is not an enumerated power. In other words, if you read the Constitution, those powers are not explicitly listed. They're not articulated. They're not defined. And so we're already operating in something of a gray area. And then going beyond that, the constitutional system was very much premised on loyalty to institution, not to political party. And so in thinking a little bit about the way in which the system was supposed to operate, if you read like Madison in Federalist 51, you see that there has to be this ambition counteracting ambition, institution counteracting institution. And so as a consequence, right now, without consolidated control over Congress as a whole, the House and the Senate, there's very little that the House can do to enforce something like a contempt resolution. They can attempt to take it to court. But the problem, if you're thinking about having prosecution of Barr, well, that would be done by the DOJ. So that's
Department
out.
Of Justice, right? Right. Point I've made many times.
Yes. And so then you say, okay, well, you could take it to courts and hope that the courts would enforce it. But then it becomes an issue of time, and that seems to be what's so at issue. Now, going back to your point about the Nadler versus Barr, and perhaps maybe Nadler versus Trump to a certain extent. What we see in the exchange of letters, the exchange of requests for information, I think are two sides that are carefully constructing a case that will be played out in court. If you recall back a little while ago, Nadler asked or released subpoenas for, from 81 separate people asking for documents and materials. And the response was like, whoa, that seems like way too much. Why did you move so quickly on that? Well, in some ways, you're looking at the totality of the recalcitrance among executive officials and the Trump administration. And on the flip side, right, we see the response by Barr to some of Nadler's requests. He's not saying that they are absolutely refusing to produce the Mueller report. Now that Trump has invoked executive privilege, it is a provisional assertion, and that could be waived at another time. So they're both in some ways attempting to make claims here that will be adjudicated perhaps by a judge. And so there's an attempt to look at kind of like the reasonableness of the parties, the degree of recalcitrance among the two actors. So we see something of a framing of the respective sides through Nadler's and Barr's actions, very much, I think, with courts in mind.
I respectfully disagree with you. I think maybe what's going on here is Nadler sees political gold here, and that it has to do with the constitutional system. You must be a pig in mud here, because you've got to be very happy, because now we see these two branches of government, as you've just been talking about, you know, up against each other, and we have to consider what the framers meant and the rest. Now, I have been silent about this. I think Mitch McConnell may be the third or fourth worst person in government at this stage of the game. But McConnell, who thought maybe Mueller should testify or could testify, now he says he shouldn't. Whatever the president wants, that's what McConnell is going to give him. So what does he risk? What does he gain?
What does he risk? Well, let's go, I guess, with the gain. I mean, look, he's, I think, been a majority leader who has been very, very content with getting conservative judges and justices on the federal bench, and been okay with doing very little else. Obviously, reducing corporate tax burden, I like that. But otherwise, you know, this is not an individual who wants to have a robust legacy of legislation, right? He just doesn't seem concerned with that at all, and is perfectly happy to do the things that will just tie up the Senate, right? And as a consequence, right, we don't see a lot of senatorial momentum towards much of anything, including things, by the way, that where there seem to be other areas of potential bipartisan support. So we saw Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi announce that they had come to a preliminary agreement with President Trump on an infrastructure deal that they might be able to move forward on.
I wouldn't hold my breath.
No, not at all. But I mean, one of the reasons is that Mitch McConnell basically already signaled his distaste for that kind of a package. And so, you know, it's one of those things that he just doesn't seem to be very interested in doing very much. And sometimes that works very well for protecting the president's priorities. And other times that works well for protecting individual members of the Senate. But it just doesn't seem like there's much momentum towards anything of substance.
I got a minute, but I wanted to ask you, the Trump's taxes have been uncovered by the New York Times, but not the last 6 or 7 years, before that. What do you make of it?
I mean, I think this is a really interesting story, right? Because there are two different things going on here. One, this clearly attacks Trump's kind of narrative that, you know, it deconstructs the notion that he's this ultra-successful, ultra-rich individual. And so it very much kind of needles him. Now, that doesn't have a kind of big effects in terms of, you know, moving popular opinion, I don't believe, or anything along those lines. But it definitely needles him. This is the kind of stuff that gets under his skin. But I think also some of it makes the case that Democrats have been making, that we have to understand where Trump's finances are coming from, a much stronger case, right? If you see somebody that's lost $1 billion in a decade, there's an obvious question of, okay, where's the money coming from, right? Especially once, you know, daddy's not there to give it to you anymore.
And did the Russians give it to you when daddy disappeared?
Exactly. And so some of these claims that are being made to protect the release of Trump's taxes, that there's no rational or no reasonable cause for having the tax releases go to different House committees, that seems to be undermined in some ways by this point. So I think that's important. And then lastly, I think it's worth noting that if you can get the current tax documents, then you can begin taking a deeper look at things like emoluments, whether in fact foreign governments have been flooding money into his properties, and that has made him personally more wealthy.
Always great to talk to Brad Hayes, Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College and Scholar in Residence right here at WAMC. Thank you so much, Brad.
Thanks, Alan.